Dear friends of Union University, I bring you greetings from Beeson Divinity School at Samford University. It's a joy to share this special Founders Day service with all of you at Union University. In the middle decades of the 19th century, no figure so dominated the life of Baptists in the South, especially in Tennessee, as did Robert Boite Crawford Howell, R.B.C. Howell, longtime pastor of First Baptist Church of Nashville, four times president of the Southern Baptist Convention. He was a man of lively eyes, florid complexion, brilliant brown hair, and a face that beamed with good feelings toward everybody around him. He was also an indefatigable promoter and entrepreneur of Baptist causes, Sunday school, foreign missions, publications, benevolence, and not least, education. Concerned about the lack of pastoral preparation among Baptists in Tennessee, he organized in 1836 an educational society for ministerial improvement and obtained a charter for a school to be named Union, so-called because still managed by Baptists. It was to be non-sectarian in spirit, open to students from various denominations. Preacher boys could attend for free as long as their home church approved, regardless of their denomination. This new school opened on May the 8th, 1841, in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, something of a frontier town in those days, with four times as many saloons as churches. Life was hazardous in those days in Murfreesboro, and while Union had strict rules against card playing, liquor drinking, and saloon visiting, sometimes things did get out of hand. In the spring of 1855, for example, a Union student was killed in a drunken brawl in the town square. And 4 years later, another was shot to death in an argument over a shoe repair bill. But in 1850, when Union's first president, Reverend Joseph H. Eaton, delivered the first commencement address, he spoke in high tones of the purpose of this school. Union, he said, would be a wellspring to irrigate and fertilize the barren wastes of ignorance. Here, he believed, would be trained many an active and efficient herald of the cross, whose labor will bless the Church of Christ and advance the highest interest of mankind and thus promote the glory of God. To Union's first graduating students, he said, "Your lot is cast in eventful times. In an age of the world's history when vast achievements are being accomplished, and the swelling waves of revolutions in governments long established are rolling with tremendous force over the broad ocean of humanity. The human mind lies no longer dormant and motionless. It is wide awake and ever on the alert." What they had learned at Union, Eaton said, would be more valuable than all the gold in California as they went forth to make their mark in such turbulent times. And 1850 was a turbulent time in the history of the world. From Budapest to Paris, the revolutions of 1848 had changed the political landscape of Europe, while in America, the fabric of the Republic was more and more frayed by compromises that did not work and a growing enmity between North and South. In fact, the Civil War would bring to a close the first chapter in the history of Union University, if not the death of the dream, which gave it birth and then rebirth here in Jackson. In the years between President Eaton's first commencement address and the closing of Union in 1861, another revolution, in fact, a religious civil war, was unfolding among Baptists in the South, and Union University was the cauldron of this conflict. when the federal troops occupied Nashville, R.B.C. Howell, pastor of the First Baptist Church, was put in jail by order of Governor Andrew Johnson because, true Confederate that he was, he would not swear allegiance to the United States of America. While in jail, Howell wrote a history of the Baptist movement in Tennessee, in which he pointed to three great controversies that had devastated Baptist churches in this state. First, he said, there was the controversy over hyper-Calvinism. Then the so-called Reformation of Alexander Campbell. And most recently, that is in the 1850s, the rise of the Landmark Movement. Scarcely had we begun to recover from one calamitous division when we fell into another, Howell lamented. Will the Baptists of Tennessee ever be united and labor together continuously in the cause of Christ? Now, while union was to be affected in some extent by all of these movements, Landmarkism, the third controversy Howell mentioned, was virtually born, nurtured, and promoted at this school, with consequences that still reverberate among Southern Baptists to this very day. And that is the story I want to tell in this lecture today. What was Landmarkism, and how did it become so entwined with Union University? To answer these questions, we have to tell the story of two remarkable men, James Robinson Graves, J.R. Graves, a powerful trustee at Union for 40 years, and James Madison Pendleton, so-called because he was born during the presidency of James Madison, J.M. Pendleton, the first professor of theology and the second president of Union. Graves was the prophet of Landmarkism. J.M. Pendleton was its publicist and most systematic thinker. For a few short years, their lives entwined together at Union University, and the history of American Christianity was forever changed by that association. J.R. Graves was not a Southerner. He was a New Englander born in Chester, Vermont in 1820. He moved to Nashville in 1845, where he became pastor of the Second Baptist Church and associate editor of a religious paper, later called the Tennessee Baptists, a popular journal founded by R.B.C. Howell himself. These were days of intense denominational rivalry on the frontier. The competition for souls was fierce, and theological mudslinging was a popular pastime for almost everybody. In an age before television, radio, and automobiles, theological debates had something of the allure of professional wrestling today. And J.R. Graves was a combination of Hulk Hogan and Jesse Ventura in the 19th century. Nobody could hold a candle to him. Baptists, Methodists, Presbyterians, followers of Alexander Campbell all had their favorite champions who sometimes drew crowds of thousands to hear debates about predestination or infant baptism or the proper form of church government. J.R. Graves was ready-made for this kind of polemical theater. When R.B.C. Howell was attacked by the Methodist of Tennessee as that inflated bird of Nashville, bigoted, morally putrid, a man who acts more like a pope than a pastor, Graves rushed to the defense of his beleaguered colleague. He could stand toe-to-toe with the rowdiest debater and demagogue of the day. Someone described his style like this. He was a knight clad in full armor. With glittering sword, he stood in the arena, a Samson among the Philistines. When he unshackled his sword, he threw the scabbard away. Only victory or death closed his battles. He took no prisoners. Now later, Graves and Howell would fall out. They would suffer a bitter alienation and become fierce enemies. One an immovable object, the other an irresistible force. A Union student named Major Penn once drove Graves in a one-horse buggy to debate with a Methodist preacher named Chapman. Graves' words, Penn said, were like chain shot from a rifle cannon. Another person said he rode 60 miles on horseback to hear Graves preach just one sermon. He was equally at home in the city or before the rural throngs that hung upon his words. Time lost its measure. In the mighty sweep of his eloquence, he would mention with candor so many relevant things that his hearers felt there was no limit to the great things he could tell. And his exhilaration was so great that he seemed tireless. And so when he would essay to close, clamors rang out from many parts of the audience. Go on, go on, go on. As someone who preaches from time to time, I've seldom had that experience myself. But Graves was just different. It was Graves who coined the term landmark. And he based it on a verse in the Bible, Proverbs 23:10. Remove not the old landmark. As Fred Kendall observed in his History of Tennessee Baptists, Graves at one level was genuinely concerned about Christian unity. It was the same question that haunted Joseph Smith, the Mormon prophet, who was also born in Vermont, not very far from Graves' birthplace. How can so many diverse denominations be right? And if only one of them is right, which one is it? And how can I know that? Since everybody appealed to the Bible, this did little to solve the dilemma. 10,000 reformers, like so many moles, have plowed all the Bible and cut it in holes. And each has his church at the end of his trace, built up as he thinks of the subjects of grace. Joseph Smith resolved this dilemma by receiving, as he said, a brand new divine revelation, along with a set of new scriptures written on golden plates. Thus, the true church, which had lapsed with the death of the apostles, was restored in the Latter-day Saints. But Graves and the landmarkers solved this problem a different way. They asserted that Baptist churches were the only true churches because they had maintained an unbroken continuity through the ages. Thus, there was no need to restore the true church, for Baptists had never lost it. Indeed, Baptist churches were the only true churches that had ever existed in the world, all others being mere human societies or apostate deviations from the Baptist norm. If the idea of Baptist church succession, as this view was called, the idea of an unbroken chain of true Baptist churches, if this was taken seriously, it would require a kind of Baptist high church and he was ready to launch a public crusade to promote them. It was 150 years ago, on June the 24th, 1851, at a place called Cotton Grove, near Jackson, in Madison County, that Graves set forth a series of five questions, later known as the Cotton Grove Resolutions. The five basic points of landmarkism were set forth in these five queries. Number one, can Baptists recognize those societies not organized according to the pattern of the Jerusalem church as churches of Christ? Number two, ought they to be called gospel churches or churches in any religious sense? Number three, ought their ministers to be recognized as gospel ministers? Number four, is it not virtually a recognition of them to invite them into the pulpits of Baptist churches? Number five, ought Baptists to call brethren those who profess Christianity but do not have the doctrine of Christ or walk according to His commandments? Now, of course, Graves answered no to all of these questions. These were the old landmarks he believed Baptists should affirm and enforce in all of their associations. And along with that were three other practices he thought Baptists should shun and refuse to do. One was what he called alien immersion, which has nothing to do with ET, but has everything to do with baptizing those who have been accepted in other denominations, receiving them into a Baptist church. That was not to be done, even if they were baptized by immersion as believers. Two, open communion. This was the idea that the Lord's Supper belonged to a local church, and it could only be received by members of that local church or others who were in close Baptist affiliation with them. And three, pulpit affiliation. The idea that ministers from other denominations might sometimes preach in a Baptist church from a Baptist pulpit. All of these were forbidden, according to J.R. Graves. Now, at times it seemed that Graves and the Landmarkers were saying that Baptists were the only true Christians. Indeed, out on the stump, Graves could wax eloquent in this regard. Would you be a true Christian? Then have a Baptist heart. Have no other. Have a real Baptist heart, my brother. A good round heart, not a flat, sobby one, but a firm, round one whose every throb is for the cause of Christ. To be a full Baptist is the highest glory of man. To be all that man can be, a Christian in its best sense, a patriot, a republican, the friend of God and the friend of man. Now, this certainly sounds like old-fashioned Baptist brag and strut. Baptist, 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 I'll be Baptist till I die, and when I go to heaven, I'll eat that Baptist pie. But in fact, when pressed on this matter, Graves would not go so far as to deny that there may be some true believers in Christ outside the Baptist fold. But what he was adamant about was that there could be no true churches other than Baptist ones, nor any genuine ministers of the gospel than those validly ordained in Baptist churches. Now, Graves found a very able collaborator to help promote these ideas in J.M. Pendleton. The two men had become acquainted in 1852 when Graves held a revival at Pendleton's church in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Graves began to raise money for a new chair of theology at Union, and he lobbied for J.M. Pendleton to move to Murfreesboro and become the first incumbent in this new chair. In 1857, Pendleton agreed and took up his new post while also serving as a pastor of the First Baptist Church of Murfreesboro. And when President Eaton died, Pendleton was elected as his successor, the second president of Union. Howell didn't like any of this. He didn't like Graves, and he didn't like Pendleton. And after Pendleton moved to Murfreesboro, Howell said, Landmarkism became the hobby of Union faculty and students alike. Now, some of Howell's criticism might be read in the light of his antagonism toward Graves. There's some evidence that he didn't mind being called the Pope of Nashville, and that, in fact, he did consider Middle Tennessee and especially Union as his personal fiefdom. But nonetheless, his complaints about a landmark takeover of Union University were not completely unjustified. In its earliest days, Union had been open to the larger evangelical world, as its very name, Union, indicates. Students welcome from many denominations. When the Methodists held a revival in 1851, Union students attended, and some 15 of them were converted. But as the decade of the 1850s wore on, and landmark distinctives became more and more a test of fellowship, this attitude began to change. Pendleton, it was said, made Baptist students conform to Baptist principles. It became taboo, for example, for a Baptist boy to marry a Methodist or Presbyterian girl, or even to have a sweetheart outside the Baptist flock. Now, since dancing, the theater, and the circus were all prohibited activities anyway, going to church together was about the only legitimate form of romancing allowed in those days. With the new landmark-inspired strictures, however, even this activity was carefully limited. Union students and faculty were also encouraged not to patronize non-Baptist businesses in Murfreesboro. Now, this might seem to be unduly harsh, since presumably Methodist salt and Presbyterian gunpowder would work just as well as those sold by Baptist merchants. But the birds of a feather philosophy was extended even to the economy. During Pendleton's last years at Union, the college began to decline. He himself found himself more and more isolated and caught in a terrible vice between his theological views on the one hand and his political loyalties on the other. As Keith Idle has pointed out, Pendleton combined an unusual mixture of conservative and progressive ideas. He never sympathized with the Southern cause, and in fact, encouraged students not to serve in the Southern armies unless they could be chaplains. He was not an abolitionist, he said, but an emancipationist, the same view that was held before the Civil War by Abraham Lincoln, that slavery should gradually be abolished. But Pendleton's Yankee sympathies produced a crisis in the landmark movement. Graves traveled to Murfreesboro and pleaded with him one day for 4 hours to change or at least moderate his pro-Yankee views. But Pendleton would not do so. Living in fear of his life, he arranged for a Union ministerial student named G.W. Welch to take his wife and children by carriage to Ohio while he followed incognito by another route. After the war, Pendleton was a successful pastor in Pennsylvania, but he never returned to the South. He never renounced his landmark views, though in the more moderate northern clime, he did not press them as strictly nor advocate them as strongly as he had in his antebellum days at Union. With its president fled, its students dispersed, many of them serving in the Southern armies, its building confiscated and used as a hospital, first by the Southern and then by the Northern soldiers, Union University was forced to close. Graves was able to escape from Nashville by the skin of his teeth as the federal troops entered that city, but his antagonist, R.B.C. Howell, was not so lucky. He was arrested, imprisoned, because he would not swear allegiance to the United States. From the confines of his Nashville jail, Howell looked back on the history of Tennessee Baptists with lamentation and sadness. 10 years ago, he said, the garden of the Lord was blooming and beautiful. Now it is a solitary wilderness. And while the war itself had done much to wreak havoc, Howell places great blame on J.R. Graves and the landmark movement he had led. The landmarkers, he said, have injured us all by promoting a false pride, by emphasizing formalities, churchism, and externals above true spiritual values. They have cut off our approach to our erring brethren of other denominations. And what effect has landmarkism had upon the denominational schools, male and female, in Middle Tennessee and North Alabama? Not one of them remains, Howell said. Even Union University, which they had completely subsidized to their own purposes, is no more. It sleeps the sleep of death. Never, Howell said, has a cause so feeble resulted in a disaster so lamentable. What will be the future of landmarkism? God only knows. Whether it is to expire in the storm of civil war that now overwhelms us, or whether when that has passed away, it is to go on in its blighting career, only the future can tell. Though Howell was released from prison and reinstated in his pulpit, his health was broken from the harsh treatment he had received, and he died 3 years later in 1868. J.R. Graves, having been rebuked and excommunicated from the First Baptist Church of Nashville for his contumacious opposition to Howell and his effort to divide the church over the landmark cause, left Nashville for good, moving his operation to Memphis. But he continued to serve as a trustee at Union when it was revived and assimilated to Southwestern Baptist University here in Jackson. And in 1877, the ministerial students and ordained members of the faculty organized the J.R. Graves Society of Religious Inquiry, a kind of theological debating club that used to meet every Friday afternoon from 3 to 5 o'clock. Apparently, this group served as a sort of heresy filter, for according to one observer, if a preacher boy shows symptoms of unsoundness, he is handled unmercifully, and the kinks in his theology are soon smoothed out. Well, Graves would have liked that, I think. He died in Memphis in 1893, but landmarkism did not expire with the death of its founder. A Union graduate named T.P. Crawford and his wife, Martha Foster Crawford, carried landmark ecclesiology all the way to the mission field in China, claiming that mission should be supported only by local churches and not by a centralized denominational bureaucracy. This led to a break with the Foreign Mission Board and the formation of a separate landmark denomination centered in Arkansas and Texas, which continues to exist to this day. And the shadow of Union also fell across another major landmark controversy at the end of the 19th century. This one involving the president of Southern Seminary in Louisville, a former Union student named W.H. Whitsitt, who claimed that Baptists had indeed come from the Reformation and had begun to practice immersion only in 1641. This was heresy to the landmarkers, and Whitsitt was forced to resign. The charge against him led by another Union student and sometime professor, T.T. Eaton, the son of Union's first president. Now, what can we learn from all this history of conflict and schism, of excommunication and recrimination? Perhaps the greatest lesson we can learn is simply that the past is never really past, as William Faulkner, a landmarker of another sort, once said. In 1858, John Steele wrote an article on landmarkism which ended with this sentence: "The impulses set in motion by J.R. Graves and the Baptist family have not yet spent their force, and their final and total effects remain to be seen." He was right. The ghosts of Graves and Howell, Pendleton and Crawford, Whitsitt and Eaton still stalk the Southern Baptist Zion today. they posed three questions which we still wrestle with today. A historical question, an ecclesiological question, and an ecumenical question. In each case, we have something positive to learn from the landmarkers, and in each case, something also to turn away from, to resist, and be wary of. The historical question: where did Baptists come from? The landmarkers were right to remind us of Jesus' promise that he would build his church and the gates of hell would never prevail against it. God has never left himself without a witness, even in the darkest times. But they were wrong to identify that church with a dubious lineage of heretical sectarian groups such as Montanists, Novatians, the Cathari, and so on. No, Whitsitt was right. Baptists are a movement of the Reformation. We are children, or at least stepchildren, of the Reformation. And we have every reason to affirm, as the Baptist who wrote the Second London Confession of 1689 did, that wholesome Protestant theology, justification by faith alone, through grace alone, in Jesus Christ alone. The second question, the ecclesiological question: where is the true church? The landmarkers were right here to emphasize the centrality of the local congregation, the covenanted community of baptized believers. For Christ, in his three offices of prophet, priest, and king, are congregationally realized in the life of his people. And yet the landmarkers were wrong, dead wrong, to reject the historic Baptist doctrine of the universal church, the body of Christ composed of all of the redeemed, of all of the ages. They were wrong to equate the church with the kingdom of God, and wrong to see how God was at work, sometimes in surprising ways, outside the Baptist fold. And finally, the ecumenical question: what are the limits of Christian cooperation and fellowship? Again, the landmarkers were right to warn against an uncritical ecumenism, unity at any price. We do not seek togetherness for its own sake, nor unity apart from truth. But can there not be cooperation without compromise? An ecumenism of conviction, not accommodation. No doubt J.R. Graves would be astonished to hear that in recent years, the Southern Baptist Convention has been addressed by a Presbyterian, James Kennedy, a Nazarene, James Dobson, and that other non-Baptists like R.C. Sproul or Bill Hybels or Chuck Swindoll or Richard Foster sell more books at Lifeway than most of us Southern Baptists do and have great influence among our Southern Baptist people. He would be even more astonished were he to look up the annual of the Southern Baptist Convention from 1994, 6 years ago, and discover that a Roman Catholic nun, Mother Teresa, was commended for giving a stirring rebuke on the sanctity of life to Southern Baptist President Bill Clinton, and that her remarks were recorded in the annual of the Southern Baptist Convention itself. Today we know more than Graves knew because we live in a different world. Today we know that differences within a denomination can be greater than those among different denominations. And while we are grateful and ever should be grateful to God for our Baptist heritage, we can rejoice and even participate in ways that do not compromise our conscience in what God in His sovereign freedom is doing among Presbyterians and Methodists and Lutherans and Anglicans and Bible churches and even Roman Catholics and Orthodox believers. It is fitting that the painting which hangs in the foyer here of Union University includes worthies such as both J.R. Graves and R.B.C. Howell, both J.H. Eaton and J.M. Pendleton, because Union, in a sense, gave birth to all of them, their contradictory ideas and their snarling disputes. From a higher place now, they look down upon us, we who are still caught in the fray of battle, and with a greater wisdom than they once had or that we now possess, they encourage us to be faithful to Jesus Christ, the author and finisher of our faith, the Lord of the church, which he purchased with his own blood. And I believe they would all of them join us in singing as we did today, the church's one foundation is Jesus Christ, her Lord. May God bless Union University and keep it faithful to its Lord for centuries to come. Thank you.